Have you ever heard anyone say that God chose to write the New Testament in Greek because it's such an incredibly precise language? I've heard plenty of people make this claim, including pastors and professors of Greek, exalting it as having an almost supernatural precision. Can this be true, or is Greek just a language like every other language, with its own idiosyncrasies, ambiguities, strengths, and weaknesses? This is an issue we need to explore because it gets at the heart of Bible translation, raising the question, if Greek is magically precise, more than all other languages, aren't we losing that precision in translation? Stick around to find out. This is Working for the Word, and I'm Andrew Case. Here we go. Now, before we get started, just a little housekeeping. As you may have noticed, I don't run ads on this podcast and don't plan to do that ever. I don't have a team of people who help me, so I do all the research, planning, writing, editing, interviewing, and sound production myself. It's not a money-making funnel, but rather a labor of love intended to bless both translators and the wider church. So I'm not asking for donations. Just one thing. It would be awesome if you helped spread the word. Word of mouth and social media is great, and I've learned recently that subscribing and leaving reviews on Apple Podcasts prompt the algorithms to make this podcast easier for people to discover. So this is just a small request that you take a second to help in that way, and you'll have my utmost gratitude. Now back to the topic at hand. Does Greek have a magically superior pinpoint precision? I invited Nat Erickson to walk us through the answer to this question, and I was so pleased with how well he prepared and how detailed and articulate his presentation was. So who is Nat? Well, he's on the tail end of completing a PhD in New Testament at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he's researching how information structure affects constituent order in paraphrastic constructions in Koine Greek, focusing on non-New Testament Jewish and Christian writings. He blogs regularly about Greek and aspects of New Testament study at ntgreeketall.com. He has a wife and three kids and has learned the hard way that raising kids while writing a dissertation is not easy. And they live in Houghton, Michigan.
This is an interesting topic to me personally. So I kind of grew up with some sort of this view, which is interesting because in my church background, nobody knew any Greek that I'm aware of. And yet there is still this view around that Greek was a super precise language, which is odd that people who don't know Greek at all would be making claims about how Greek works. And came into that in my seminary days when I started learning Greek seriously. I'd done a little dabbling myself before that. I remember talking to someone who was in a class who was reading non-New Testament Greek. And I had thought like, boy, it would be hard to separate Greek as like God's word from just normal Greek. Now, at this point in my life, I read way more Greek outside of the New Testament than in it. But kind of that development there in my own thinking, going from Greek is precise as part of my theology of understanding the Bible to that's not really the way it works, but to where this view comes from. I think there's three ways that it's supported and continued. And one is quite simply that Greek is an intellectual prestige language in Western culture. So Greek and Latin sit at the fount of Western culture. You know, we have the common phrase, it's Greek to me, when something is confusing or considered a high intellectual idea. Nobody says it's Swahili to me, although that would get the same point across because right, we don't really care in Western culture about Swahili, but Greek is an intellectual language. So it's an important language, ergo it must be special in some way. So there's that part of it, just in the culture at large, Greek is significant. A second part that supports this is, especially when pastors do some study of Greek in seminary or Bible college, you're struck right away by how different it is from English. And for most people, they've never seriously even studied English or any other language. And so like it blows all of your mental categories for language out of the water So it must be super, right? They just can sit down with a 1400 page long grammar of Greek. It's like, wow, this is an incredible language. And you have probably never sat down with a 1400 page long grammar of English and done the same thing and look at how English works. So it just got that aspect of, it is very different from English. And if your only category is there's English, which I speak, and then there's Greek, which is super precise because look at these grammars, it's easy to see why people get that impression. And then the last one, which I think is really the most significant that keeps supporting this view of Greek as precise, is that it ties into a broader theology of the Bible and of God's word, God's revelation. And that, I think, is actually what supports it, what keeps the view around. As we'll talk a little bit, I don't think the view is intellectually defensible to claim that Greek is super precise or the most precise language. And yet, it works theologically very nice in certain ways. So that's what I think is kind of the three legs that hold up this stool. We've got just Greek's place in our culture, the fact that most people studying Greek in the church world don't really study other languages, and then the theology of the Bible and God's revelation in it. So with kind of that background, I want to think now, what is it that people claim for Greek? So if you poke around on the blogosphere, come across a few places where people have been willing to put down their thoughts on paper, as it were, what they mean when they're saying that Greek is precise. So what does this precision idea rest on? And one of the things that comes up a lot is what I'll call the morphosyntax of Greek. So it's morphologically complicated compared to English, and it is syntactically complicated compared to English. Now, almost all of my examples here will be compared to English, since we're doing this in English. English is the only language I speak fluently. I read several other ones, but it's the only language I'm fluent in. So almost all of my examples are going to be tied to English. And I don't know how big this issue is outside of the English speaking world. So just a caveat there is carry this on.
Sure.
But so morphosyntax. So in English, a noun has two forms, dog and dogs, singular, plural. That's it. In Greek, a noun has at least eight different forms, and some have a couple more. So right off the bat, that looks pretty cool coming from an English perspective. Like there's a lot going on in this noun system that's just different from English. And then we go in and say, well, in English, a verb has at most five distinct forms. So to use the verb take, you've got take, takes, taking, took, and taken. Right, so that's five distinct forms. Normal verbs, so regular verbs, only have four distinct forms. So if there isn't a vowel change within the verb, it only has four forms. Compare that to a Greek verb, which has greater than 100 distinct forms. I don't remember the exact number. I think it's somewhere around 200 distinct forms that it can appear in. That's pretty cool. Right? Once you account for all the different morphological manipulations, there's lots of Greek verb forms, and there's not very many in English. In the indicative mood, Greek has seven tenses. And outside of that, there's three tenses in the different moods, or four, depending on the mood. It just looks really complicated. Now, you may have noted that I didn't actually say the same things for those comparisons of English and Greek. Talk about like tense forms in Greek, just the basic naked forms the verb can appear in English. And that's intentional and significant. And it's a point that people enamored with the precision of Greek fail to appreciate. So in a fundamental way, the Greek and English verbal systems are simply different from each other. There's no easy way to compare them. And just counting forms is misleading. So, for example, a lot of the forms in Greek are just different forms of the participle having gender and case. So you get lots of different participle forms. Well, there's nothing exactly analogous to that in English, so we get by with just one participle form, which incidentally is what modern Greek uses as well. There's basically two forms of the participle, slightly more complicated, but way less complicated than ancient Greek. But the comparison there, it doesn't really hold. Just saying there's lots of forms in Greek, therefore it's precise, and there's not very many in English. Well, they simply work different. Or again, to say that Greek has lots of tenses or tense forms, it's a misleading way of describing things, both Greek internally and compared to English. So for instance, English has only two morphologically distinct tense forms for each verb. There's a past tense form and a non-past tense form. So you have ran and run, paint and painted. So there's only two morphologically distinct forms for an English verb. So if you count by morphology, you say English has two tenses. But if we take into account how English actually works, things are a lot more complicated. There's as many as 12 tenses in English. It depends. Different people have different numbers depending on their theories. But there's over 100 possible distinct verbal forms once you start taking into account forms like I have painted, I have been painting, I will have been painting. So that's how English does things. We use multi-word constructions to build these ideas that in Greek, you change a few letters in the verb form. So they're different. The question that arises is, why should we consider one or the other more precise? Is there anything inherent about changing the form of a verb that's more precise than adding some other words to the verb? The assumption in the Greek is precision world is that more forms equals precise. Well, that's at least an assumption, but there's no way to prove that. But that's one of the points that people who point to Greek being precise point to a lot is that morphosyntax. Greek has complicated forms and some complicated sentences, ergo it is more precise. And the second part of the argument that often gets brought up is that Greek has a very precise vocabulary. Now, it's an interesting point. Now, Greek does have a lot of words. How many words have no is kind of a difficult to say, partially because our lexicons or our dictionaries of ancient Greek generally stretch from Homer, so 800 BC, up till 400 or 500 AD. Is usually about the range that gets covered in ancient Greek dictionaries. Yeah. So that's 1,200 years. When we consider ancient Greek, are the words in Homer still words used by normal Greek speakers in 108 AD? That's an interesting question. There are several hundred thousand known ancient Greek words, which is a lot compared to many languages in the world. Compared to modern English, it's a pretty small vocabulary. Modern English probably has the claim to the most words in any language ever in existence. But more to the point, people who think Greek is precise love to point to different words for love in Greek, especially in the end of John, the Gospel of John, where Jesus is talking to Peter. Right? People love this, that there's many different words for love in Greek, which there are, or rather you could say there are no words in Greek that mean to love. That's kind of the wrong way to look at it. There are several words in Greek that partially overlap with how we use the word love in English. Or there are several Greek words that the English word love partially overlaps with. But there's none that mean the same thing. It's crossing languages. Languages have different ideas. Vocabulary works differently in different languages. It is true that Greek has a lot of neat words and a lot of precision, if you will, that's different than, say, English's precision vocabulary. But anyone who's done any meaningful study in any language knows that that's just normal across languages. Languages yeah. just work different. You need to learn different words and how those words apply to things. That's part of learning a language. So when people are pointing to precision, that's really what people keep pointing to. Complicated word forms and complicated vocabulary. I think it's significant to point to what precision is not. So when people are claiming that that Greek is very precise, one of the things they don't mean, usually, is that we understand what everything is meant to convey. So an example here, famously the Lord's Prayer, right? So there was a big to-do a couple of years ago about Pope Francis, quote unquote, wanting to change the last line in the Lord's Prayer, how it's translated, right? Lead us not into temptation, into something like, don't allow us to fall into temptation. So, right, the issue there is not that what the Greek says is unclear, right? The Greek is perfectly clear there, right? It quite literally says, lead us not into temptation. The issue is, how does that work in part of a broader understanding of the whole New Testament, the broader understanding of Jesus and praying in relation to the Father and all those things? So it's not unclear at the level of Greek. It's unclear at the level of theology and interpretation. So even people who claim Greek is very precise don't generally have that sort of unclarity in their mind. Or when Paul talks about baptism for the dead in Corinthians, what is he talking about? I don't know. Some people seem to be very sure about what he's saying, but in general, we lack information. Yeah. It's not because the Greek is unclear. It's because we really don't know what he's talking about. And that's not engaged in this discussion of precision. That's a different animal. So precision is somehow the inner workings of Greek communicate with a degree of clarity that mere mortal languages like English can't achieve. So at this stage, I want to do a thought experiment about language and precision. So most people who learn New Testament Greek historically are coming at it through already knowing another Indo-European language: English, German, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, whatever. That's even true for a lot of people who that's not their first language for. So I was at a seminary in Malawi a couple years ago. Their Greek class is taught in English, although English is not a native language for any of the people there learning it, but they're studying in English. So you already have categories of how Indo-European languages tend to work, and Greek is an Indo-European language. Now, let's imagine for a minute that we are a native speaker of a language, Tayuca. I don't know if this is actually how you pronounce the language. It's a language used in Brazil and Colombia. So we'll pretend that there's a missionary there who's teaching us Greek, who has learned our language and is teaching us in Tayuca. There's going to be something strikingly absent from Greek as we start learning it. So Tayuca, like many different languages in the world, encodes evidentiality in its verbal system. In other words, part of each well-formed verb is an indicator of how you know this piece of information, whether you personally saw it, you heard it, you've seen evidence for it, someone else has told you, etc. That's just part of their verbal system. You have to say that in order to use a verb in Tayuca. There's nothing at all like that in Greek. Actually, Greek, like English, and I think like just about every other Indo-European language, leaves evidentiality completely out of its verbal system. Yeah. We can add words in to say, I saw so-and-so do X, but in general, it's just not there. That's not how Greek works. That's not how English works. That's not how German works, and on we could go. So from the point of view of a speaker of Tayuca, Greek's verbal system is very imprecise when it comes to a feature of language that you're used to, namely evidentiality in the verbal system. Here's where I think one of the problems with the precision view really gets blown out of proportion is what people tend to think is precise about Greek is that it does most of the things that English does and then some, or it can be seen as working much like English only in a higher way, right? But because it's already so similar to English or German or French, because it's part of the same related group of languages, we don't see areas that it's vague in that our language is already vague in. If your language doesn't use evidentiality, you don't notice or care that Greek doesn't use evidentiality. Whereas if you come at it from the fact of putting evidentiality in all of your verbs, that Greek is completely imprecise with its evidentiality, just like other Indo-European languages. So I think that's a a helpful point to get at from the start with precision is we tend to view Greek as precise because it's like our language, and we don't notice the ways that Greek is inherently imprecise because it's similar to English. And that would, in my mind, raise the question, what is precision? I mean, we've already pointed to some of the things people point to, morphosyntax, vocabulary, but what is precision? If we come at Greek from a different language perspective, we can see there's things in it that are inherently ambiguous. We could do the same thing with morphosyntax, with tenses, with noun forms. We could find languages that have more cases than Greek's 4 cases or 5, depending on how you count cases. In every feature of Greek, we could find a language that does things similarly or differently. So why is Greek precise and these other languages not precise? So my basic commitment when I come to Greek is that Greek is a language. Okay, it's a human language used by people, was used by people as they wrote in the New Testament. It's instructive that after you learn well New Testament Greek, you can go and read non-New Testament Greek. Right? It works the same. It's part of the same language. While New Testament has some of its own oddities, it is part of Koine Greek, part of the Hellenistic Greek of the era. So it's a human language. And part of that, I would argue, is that it functions like human languages. At whatever level the Holy Spirit is involved in the production of the New Testament, it's below the level of normal language functionality or above the level, depending on how you want to look at it. But the Greek of the New Testament works like a language. So when we think about how languages work, we could start to think of precision in more clear ways. And I would say that there should be a two-way, or at least a two-way distinction in the way we use and think about precision as we think about people claiming that Greek is a precise language. First, a language can have precise internal mechanics, and that's significant, right? It's self-evident that compared to English, Greek has precise internal mechanics. Adjectives have to have a certain form to mark, to go with the noun that they happen to be with. Participles have a certain form depending on their function in the sentence. So these forms all are, it's a precise internal system, and it's cool. Compared to English, English's precise internal system is carried out almost exclusively in where you put the word. So that's how we get around the fact that we don't mark our adjectives for the gender of the noun they go with. Well, you just put the adjective with the noun and it's obvious what noun the adjective modifies. So there's internal precision. And we can say in terms of internal busyness of what is marked, Greek leaves English in the dust. That's just the way it works. But if you like word order more than just cool moving things around, you would say that English is way cleaner than Greek. So that is what it is. Languages just differ in how busy they are internally. The problem, though, is people who talk about the New Testament Greek as being a precise instrument of communication aren't actually talking about internal precision of how things are ordered. What they're wanting to claim is that Greek maps to reality in an inherently precise way, in a way that's somehow more precise than other languages. And that's where we run into how exactly would you know that? How is it possible to claim that a language is somehow better suited at talking about reality than another language? That's not a problem that anyone, I think, can ever solve. No one knows every language in the world as a native speaker, and no one's in the position to make that call about which one is better than others in talking about the world. But one thing that is clear is every language works well enough for the people who speak it. With that, kind of just some background on precision and imprecision, I want to go to a few examples of what I call a typology of Greek's imprecisions. So it is self-evident, like Greek is not wildly imprecise. And I don't want to suggest that at all. Sure. Most of the time, reading a Greek sentence, it's very clear what's going on in a Greek sentence, provided you already know Greek. That's also true for English or Spanish or Swahili, right? That languages, most of the time, are clear enough to get by. But there are things which happen that are just inherently imprecise. So I want to break out Greek's imprecisions into sort of three categories just to get a handle on this really huge issue.
Okay.
The first one I would point to is what I'll call grammatical and structural oddities. Just like something's going on in the text that's just strange. It's not really clear why it's happening that way. The next one after that would be structural impreciseness. So there's just aspects of how Greek works where certain vaguer ways of talking about things are more normal than certain precise ways of talking about things. And we'll discuss that a little more fully. And then the last one that I'll discuss is some examples where the internal precision of Greek, which so impresses people, there's instances where that actually makes it unclear what's going on in the text. Those are the sort of three areas I want to hit on in this typology of Greek imprecisions. And the first one, they're just grammatical structural oddities. If you look in especially some of the older Greek grammars, technical grammars of the Greek New Testament, there'll be whole sections devoted to grammatical infelicities in the Greek New Testament. And part of that is just evidence of the fact that these guys were deeply steeped in classical Greek before they come to Koine Greek. And Koine Greek is different than classical Greek. So if you're expecting it to work exactly like classical Greek, it doesn't. It is different.
Right.
So part of it is just that it's different. But there are things going on there that are simply what would appropriately be called grammatical errors or odd ways of putting things together that are inherently weird. So I just pulled an example here from the Gospel of Mark in chapter 16, where the women are going out to the tomb to visit Jesus with the intention of anointing his body in the tomb and with spices and so on. And they're talking to each other and they say, who's going to roll the stone away from the door of the tomb? And then they look up and they see that the stone was rolled away, for it was very large. So that's the order things come into. The normal way Greek would work is the clause, for it was very large, would go earlier in the sentence, actually in the verse before it appears. They're asking, who's going to roll the stone away from the tomb because it's really big? That's how Greek would normally function. Mark, for whatever reason, puts it in a weird place. So you have to sort out the order as you're reading along, you come to it and you have to mentally go back and connect it where it actually belongs in the logical flow of thought. Is that unclear? Well, no, you can figure it out. There are a couple examples in Mark where you connect it back to is significant and it's not inherently clear, but we could call that an imprecision in how Greek is being used, right? It's not the clearest possible way of communicating what's being communicated. You have to work against the order it was actually written in order to understand what it's saying. Another similar example here is in 1 John 3, verses 19 and 20. You get in here a bunch of, we just call them oti clauses in Greek, after the conjunction oti that starts them. And in verse 20, there's two of them, and they're simply odd. The syntax is very difficult because they don't obviously connect to anything. They don't obviously function in the normal way that oti clauses function. Okay, in this we know that we are from the truth and we are persuaded before him, before God, in our hearts or with our hearts, with regard to our hearts. For our hearts do not condemn us, for God is greater than our hearts and he knows all things. So I just translated them both as both the otis as for there, which is one possible way to get around it or to handle them. It works, but it's odd. So for our hearts to not condemn us, for God is greater than our hearts. So we have various possible ways of trying to reconcile this, including a popularly suggested emendation of the text to change the word oti into two words, o and t. But you could understand how those might have been combined if that was the original reading, since it's the same three letters in Greek, pronounced very similarly with just a slight pause in between them. But again, the point here is it's probably just the sort of normal grammatical infelicity that pervades normal usage of language. That's one of the reasons why we have editors for books and things that get published, is to go through and say, oh, John, this is not quite clear. Go back and fix this. That's just two examples. We could go through lots more examples of grammatical and structural oddities in the New Testament, kind of stepping on from grammatical imprecisions to what I'll call structural impreciseness. I'll just mention two pervasive categories in Greek where vagueness is just normal. So if we're aiming for Greek as a super precise language, it runs against the simple way that Greek functions, in which several constructions that are less clear than they could be are the normal way of speaking, the normal way of writing. So two of these that I'll just point to, one being the use of the genitive case. So in Greek, the genitive case limits nouns, usually limits their applicability, and it roughly correlates to various of constructions in English, possessive ideas and so forth. It's the case of qualification or limitation as to kind, and sometimes talking about separation, like spatial separation, so moving away from. So when we look at the genitive, most of the time what it's doing is clear, but as one grammarian puts it, one of the areas of great ambiguity in language involves the genitive case. So continuing a quote here, genitives are routinely used in compressed situations which need to be unpacked. The genitive is typically related to another substantive, but what that relation involves can be quite varied. So end quote. And he goes on to give an example, the revelation of Jesus Christ. So this is actually as ambiguous in English as it is in Greek. Is that Jesus revealing something, or is that Jesus being revealed? Both are possible understandings of revelation of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Again, another one being the love of God. Again, this is a common expression in the New Testament with a genitive that's inherently ambiguous. It can be used to emphasize God's love, so the love which God has, or it can be love for God. Now, children of wrath, mystery of godliness, these are all expressions that happen throughout the New Testament, which are inherently ambiguous because the genitive construction is basically a substitution for a more precise way of saying the same thing that would take longer. So instead of unpacking it into a whole clause, so instead of saying the love of God, you could say the love which we have for God, or you could say the love which God has for us, which is a lot longer than just saying the love of God. So it's a convenient way to pack things together, but it also ends up with ambiguity. So there's a very famous one in the world of New Testament studies that's been exercising a great deal of attention in the last decade or two, being pistis Christou, so faith of Jesus. Or there's this big debate, should it be understood as Jesus's faith, or should it be understood as faith in Jesus, or should it be understood as Jesus's faithfulness, and so on, right? There's a big debate about whether that's theologically significant or not. And my point here is not to solve or unpack that debate, but just to point out, if Paul's intention was to clearly identify which of those possibilities it was, there's obvious and easy ways to do that in Greek, but he just doesn't, just plops it out there using a genitive construction, carries his merry way along.
So here are some passages where the pistis Christou debate stems from. We've got Romans 3:22, which says, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. We've also got Galatians 2:16. Yet we know that a person is not justified by works of the law, but through faith in Jesus Christ. And we also have Philippians 3:9. Not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ. The righteousness from God that depends on faith. Nat, in a later correspondence said, for the record, I think the debate is blown way out of proportion, and the use of a compact genitive phrase here implies Paul is communicating something obvious to his readers rather than trying to split theological hairs. I think it basically means faith in Christ, meaning believing in Jesus.
Another pervasive imprecise construction is the predicate participle, or also called an adverbial participle. And here, in general, if you want to be specific in Greek, as in English, you use main verbs. So main verbs say, and then just link main verbs together. So this is sort of like Fun with Dick and Jane kind of composition. Everything is a main verb. And it sounds obnoxious in English. It sounds super obnoxious in Greek because that's not the main way that Greek carries things out. Greek likes to use participles that subordinate a bunch of different complex sentence parts to one main verb. Now, from a morphological perspective, this looks really precise because participles are marked for case, number, and gender, as well as different verbal qualities. So they're marked for a lot. So if you're looking at just morphological issues, you're like, wow, participles are super precise. Now, compared to English participles, they are super precise in what they're marked for. However, they're inherently ambiguous in what they mean. One grammarian describes the case in this way, so quoting here, the context has more influence on participles than on any other area of Greek grammar. In other words, for most participles, one cannot simply look at the structure to determine what kind of participle it is, and ending quote there. And this could be expanded upon by many, many more grammarians making the same point. So the Greek participle can convey ideas like temporal relations, causal ideas, all sorts of different adverbials, so the manner in which something was done. And all of these are just thrown in there as a participle. It's not anarchic. There's patterns there. But as a general rule, there's more than one possible specific semantic notion for a participle every time it's used. It's not that often that one is obviously the specific function. There's an inherent ambiguity in them. And what you see is it would always be possible, or maybe not always, at least almost always possible, to have used a more specific main verb construction to convey the same idea and to make it clear what semantic nuance is desired. So if you want to specifically emphasize the time relationship between the action and the participle and the main verb, you can do that with a main verb. If you want to emphasize purpose, you can do that with a main verb. And on we could go. And that would remove the ambiguity and make it obvious which semantic nuance the participle is intended to carry. But as a general rule, Greek writers did not do that. They like to use the participles. That's part of the normal functioning of Greek. And with that, we turn back to the precision argument and say, look, a normal pattern of Greek syntax is to use less precise than possible expressions. Now, however precise Greek can be with both this genitive case construction and the predicate participles, Greek routinely is less precise than it can be in the way it communicates things, in the way the authors use it. So as an example here with participles, here's one that gets a lot of people's blood rushing in the Gospels world. And so this is more of the world I pay lots of attention to in scholarly debate. So from Matthew 28, 19 and 20, which is a passage near and dear to many people called the Great Commission, it begins with, in Greek, a participle, porevthendes, un mathetevsates. So participle, porevthendes, un is just a conjunction, which you translate therefore in English, and then mathetevsate is an imperative. So the imperative here, the main verb is make disciples. So what is this participle in front of it doing is complicated. And some people will like to argue that The participle here means something to the effect of Jesus is commanding that as you are going, make disciples. And the emphasis there and this interpretation is that disciple making should be a process in normal life, but it's not necessarily an intentional command to go somewhere and do something. The other possible way that people argue for this text is to take the participle as what in New Testament grammars is usually called the participle of attendant circumstances. And what that means is in Greek, the participle, the predicate participle, is almost never on the main line of the discourse. So it's not of equal rank with a main verb. It gives background information or expands on information that the main verb said, but it's not the same as a main verb. Except there seem to be cases where it is, right? It functions on the main line of the discourse. And here is one instance here in Matthew 28:19, where this verb going should, or this participle going, could and probably should be understood as functionally equivalent to an imperative. So it clearly belongs in the imperative mood. It is part of the command at the very least. The argument would be that it's providing new information which cannot be assumed from context. So it's part of a different information unit from the main verb, and therefore is functioning on a higher discourse level than participles usually do, as basically equivalent to a main verb. That's the understanding that's behind most English translations, which say go and make disciples. But either way, what we've got to deal with from a Greek perspective is this is less clear than it could be. And part of that is because we approach it like English speakers, where a participle like this just doesn't work. We can't translate this participle in Greek as an English participle. There's no way around it. Going, make disciples is weird in English. And so we have to make a decision about whether to translate it as a participle or whether to turn it into an adverbial phrase, something like as you are going, make disciples, or go and make disciples.
And now, on a personal note, I can't count the number of times I've heard from pulpits and other places that interpretation of as you go, look at in Greek, it's a participle. So yeah.
Yeah. So this is one, it gets a lot of press, partially because of the role that this passage has played in modern missions, the modern missions movement, stemming all the way back to William Carey, you know, widely considered the father of modern missions and one of the first, if not the first, to argue that this is a command that actually has relevance today and not just for the apostles. You know, while I'm thinking about it now, I think this actually hits one of the pervasive issues in this precision assumption. From what I can tell in my poking around and reading different people, most people who are arguing that Greek is super precise are not very accomplished Greek scholars, shall we put it that way?
Anyway, that's all for this episode. Thanks so much for sticking around with us and learning together. In the next episode, we'll hear more from Nat on this topic. See you soon.